saw as Lesha's gaffe. At home, the Leshas took note. They had scrupulously studied the Deadhead community to build their own following. From insisting Kamok be included in the first iteration of the Other Ones to reviving old Grateful Dead songs from the 60s in Fillin' Friends, the Leshas tested their ideas for Deadhead approval. Feeling that now, they alone were proprietors of the soul of the Grateful Dead and held control, the Leshas courted the Deadheads, and it paid off for them. They knew Deadhead loyalty was a valuable commodity, and that they owed their status and power to Deadhead approval. They treated the messages they heard on the grapevine seriously. With Lesha's misstep about Jerry, their strategy for domination was immediately weakened, at a time when Lesh was, once again, tired and disgusted with his bandmates. There had been talk of a New Year's Eve show. Sidemen like Haynes and Herring kept their calendars open. Weir spoke optimistically after the tour about the band's plans for making new music to Rolling Stone. "I don't know if albums are the way it's going to be done anymore," he said. "With downloading, the album may be an obsolete concept. If there is some reason to put out a group of songs together, we may do that. We'll be recording all along. We've written a few new songs already." But any future hinged on Phil Lesh, who, again, wasn't as interested and couldn't be reached as easily. After his equal share of the Dead tour amounted to substantially less net revenue to Lesh than his Phil and Friend shows, he began to rethink his collaboration with the Others. He decided he wanted future income prorated with him to receive a larger portion. He reasoned that he was clearly the main attraction in the band, a measurably larger draw than any of the Others, and, as such, should be rewarded appropriately. Without him, the Others would not make as much money, even with the reduced shares called for in his new plan. Naturally, this did not go over well in the all-for-one, one-for-all world of the Grateful Dead, and, as the Leshes grew even more remote, the Others slowly began to realize that Lesh had once again taken his ball and gone home, and that the incarnation of the band called the Dead was finished. Chapter 13. Jammies. Phil Lesh didn't get out much when he wasn't playing, so the invitation to host the 5th Annual Jammy Awards at the theater at Madison Square Garden in April 2005 was also a welcome opportunity for him to cross paths with a broad cross-section of like-minded musicians. The event, which had graduated the previous year from the much more intimate Roseland Ballroom to the bigger room, was the brainchild of executive producer Peter Shapiro, a rising young impresario who ran a rock club and Deadhead community center in Tribeca called The Wetlands, along with Relics editor Dean Budnick. While the bands appearing at Shapiro's club were diverse in style, from Afrobeat to British blues, the common bond between the bands and the audience was a devotion to jamming. At his club and his Jammy Awards, Shapiro represented this subculture of the pop music mainstream, a thriving scene not reflected on the radio or Billboard album charts, a genuine underground phenomenon that had been growing quietly over the 10 years since Garcia's death in the NSYNC/Backstreet Boys/Britney era of pop. It was a movement that owed its entire existence to the model of the Grateful Dead. The Jammy Awards ceremony exists to celebrate the world that was mainly created by the Grateful Dead, said the New York Times. A world of rock-based improvisers, eager to extend their digressive songs by incorporating bits of country and jazz and the blues. The Grateful Dead's leader, Jerry Garcia, died a decade ago, but the group is still at the center of the jam band universe. The Grateful Dead bassist, Phil Lesh, served as the evening's host, and Grateful Dead-related projects took home a handful of awards. In the 8 months since the last Dead concert, Lesh had been largely holed up, writing his autobiography, which was published the week before he appeared as host at the sold-out event in New York City. He had been signed to a lucrative book deal the year before by Michael Peach, a publishing industry heavyweight running the Little Brown House at the time. Working without a ghostwriter, Lesh had cranked out, searching for the sound, My Life with a Grateful Dead, and had been quiet, save for a couple of one-off fill-in friends dates around town. The jammies was kind of a coming-out party for him. None of his bandmates would be around to share the spotlight. Even if the future of the Dead was in limbo, the band nevertheless won the award for Best Download for the live recording from the 2004 Bonnaroo Festival, and Lesh acted like nothing was wrong, the first real rule of show business. This proves it is possible not only to survive, but prevail, said Lesh, accepting the award. Lesh presided over an extraordinary evening of music, beginning with his fellow Marin County rock star, Huey Lewis, about to make his Broadway debut in the musical Chicago, who joined South Bend, Indiana jam rockers Umphrey's McGee to sing I'll Take You There, along with Mavis Staples and a subdued Sinead O'Connor, who returned later to join reggae pioneer Burning Spear. Bruce Hornsby sang one of his songs with Yonder Mountain String Band. Peter Frampton reprised his Do You Feel Like We Do with alternative rockers Guster. The Disco Biscuits backed country star Travis Tritt in a lengthy exploration of his hit Honky Tonk History. Lesh anchored the Walloping Blues Jam with drummer Questlove and guitarists Buddy Guy and John Mayer. But the single most mind-boggling moment of the momentous night belonged to Ryan Adams, alt-rock brat with a classic rock swagger, hardly a beloved figure with the jam band crowd. Lesh joined Adams and his country rock-oriented band, the Cardinals, as the 30-year-old singer-guitarist, glasses sliding down his nose, hair hanging in his face, took possession of Garcia's Wharf Rat, pulling it apart and putting it back together in front of Lesh's eyes, bawling, mewling, grating his way through a 12-minute odyssey before a house full of skeptical deadheads won over halfway through the first chorus. Lesh struggled to keep up, but stood there, a grin plastered across his face, amazed at what he saw, like any other fan, only with a better seat. If he was casting around for a lead vocalist for Phil and Friends that coming summer, he could not have found a better candidate. Lesh also reacquainted himself backstage with guitarist Larry Campbell, whom he knew from touring with Bob Dylan. After 7 years, Campbell had left his post in Dylan's band only 4 months before. He had been working as the informal music director of the Midnight Rambles, weekly Saturday concerts held at the barn owned by Levon Helm in Woodstock, New York, as a means of helping cover some of Helm's medical expenses and helping him ease back into playing music after a severe bout with cancer. He had never been a Deadhead, although Working Man's Dead and American Beauty had caught the country music-loving Campbell's attention, and he had watched with interest during that first 1999 tour with Dylan when Lesh had Robin Ford and the two guys from Little Feat in his band. When Lesh mentioned backstage at the Jammies that they should play together sometime, Campbell had no idea how few guitar players Lesh knew. Lesh used guitarist Jimmy Herring for the Phil and Friends show in December 2004 and the February 2005 Mardi Gras shows, Lesh's only public performances since the Dead tour. On both those shows, the band was fronted by the charismatic Chris Robinson of the Black Crowes. Robinson was on the loose, having suddenly scrubbed his fall 2004 tour and fired his band, disappearing except for his two Phil and Friends shows, until a showcase with his brother Rich Robinson in February at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas paved the way for a Black Crowes reunion later in the year. Robinson was not likely to be available again for Lesh anytime soon. With his book hitting the streets, Lesh showed up in New York for the Jammies, ready to consider further musical plans. The book was a brilliant move that galvanized Lesh's standing as the leading living member of the Grateful Dead. The publishers trumpeted the New York Times bestseller as the first inside account, although roadie Steve Parrish, of all people, beat Lesh to the market the year before with his memoir of life in the Dead, Home Before Daylight. In Searching for the Sound, Lesh took charge of the narrative in subtle, telling ways, using a kind of self-serving faux honesty that impressed reviewers, but not his intimates who had lived these stories with him. It worked. In an article headlined, "Now the Dead Will Always Be With Us," the New York Times credited Lesh, following the death of Garcia, with reshaping both the band and the public's understanding of its legacy. Still, Lesh was either playing it cool or keeping his options open regarding the current status of the Dead in his musical life. In the same article, he confirmed there were plans for celebrating the band's 40th anniversary later in the year, even though he knew that would never happen. "In typical fashion, we don't know what we're going to do yet," he told the Times. Nobody was sitting at home waiting for Lesh. Weir, back on his feet, hit the road with Rat Dog in March and stayed out for months, rolling into an appearance on the main stage at Bonnaroo in June. Before the massive crowd, Weir played his manager's wet dream of a greatest hits set list, starting with Truckin' into Playing in the Band, Cassidy, Jack Straw, St. Stephen, Sugar Magnolia, if only to show them he could, but never would again. In April, Mickey Hart went out with Jamtronica specialists Particle, who dubbed the collaboration Hydra. "Hydra is extreme music," Hart said. "Extreme music for extreme people. I need it." Almost alone among his colleagues, Hart kept his antenna tuned to the contemporary music world, not the pop charts necessarily, but a phenomenon like Particle, live musicians fusing jam band instrumentals with modern electronic dance music, customarily the product of recording studios, would reach Hart's ears. He had attended raves and kept his eyes on the growth of DJ culture. Formed in Los Angeles in 2000, Particle blew up 2 years later. In 2002, one of the band's two sets at Bonnaroo started after midnight and was still going strong 5 hours later at sunrise. A few months later, the band laid waste to the jammies, backing Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson of the B-52s on a romping extended remake of Love Shack. Particle brought together strains of funk, jazz, and rock into the world of electronica, also subverting the form by performing primarily in public, up to 150 concerts a year. This was usually a producer/DJ's game, not a live band's, and was unusual in dance music circles. The jam band scene embraced the group. Fans of the band dubbed themselves Particle People, attracted to the genre-busting group whose 2004 debut album, Launchpad, was a critical and popular success. Particle keyboardist Steve Mullitz had joined Phil and Friends in December 2004 at the Warfield, but that had nothing to do with the band's collaboration with Hart, who challenged the group with his polyrhythms and space. Mullitz credited Hart with showing the band how to play with more space and patience. "I have everything all in one place," Hart told the Santa Cruz Metro. "All of my favorite processors are on stage. I can do things in this band that I couldn't do in the Grateful Dead. These kids were born digital." While the band members busied themselves with their various projects, Grateful Dead Productions CEO Cameron Sears worked at reducing the overhead and streamlining the operation. Only about 12 employees remained. He kept a skeletal office staff at a small suite on Lucas Valley Road, down the highway from Novato. Only the vault, the studio, and the funky production trailer Ramrod and Parrish kept in the parking lot were still at the old Coca-Cola plant. Sears struggled with the mission, but he plodded on, under the impression he was consolidating operations for sustainability, not closing everything down. Every few months, he would lay off another person or two. With Lesh still refusing to attend board meetings, Sears could call a quorum with the other three, but he had to deal with Lesh through fraught phone calls to Jill, often hearing Lesh in the background, offering direction, or shouting, "No, no, no!" Lesh did not mount a full-scale Phil and Friends tour that summer, but he did book a July weekend in Denver, one night at the new Denver Fillmore and the next at Red Rocks, and brought along Ryan Adams, his jammies discovery, as the band's lead vocalist. The Fillmore Auditorium in Denver was an old hall where the Dead played in 1967, when the place was operated in a short-lived, ill-fated venture by Chet Helms of San Francisco's Avalon Ballroom, called the Denver Dog. Red Rocks, of course, had been the scene of some of the greatest latter-era Dead concerts. At Red Rocks, Adams was game, but he never found the intensity of Warfrat at the Jammies. He flubbed lyrics in virtually every song, even reading from a teleprompter. Adams had not done his homework, tackling the massive songbook, and his performance teetered on catastrophe. He threw off sparks at points and tried to dig in, but spent most of the three-hour show flailing at the songs. Lesh, in an experimental mood, laughed it off. "Ryan brings the crazy," he said. If the Deadheads remained unaware of the latest break in the band, the tribute concert Comes a Time, to mark the 10th anniversary of Jerry Garcia's death in September at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, should have given them cause to ponder. A five-hour extravaganza and Rex Foundation fundraiser, the concert covered the full expanse of Garcia's career, from his beginnings in the Palo Alto bluegrass scene to his solo bands. A largely disabled Merle Saunders, Garcia's old partner around Bay Area clubs and recent victim of a stroke, hobbled out and sat at the keyboard for a few minutes to receive some applause. Rat Dog did a short set. The evening built up to a massive Grateful Dead jam session, featuring guitarists Warren Haynes and Trey Anastasio of Phish, pianist Bruce Hornsby, and the rest of the Dead guys. Only one was missing. Nobody knows why Lesh skipped the party. It is not like he wouldn't be missed. He and his wife now had their own nonprofit, and it was conceivable that he didn't want to participate in a competing foundation's fundraiser. He never said. What he did say, in a post on his website, ever conscious of Deadhead sentiment, was that he could not attend because he would be helping his son move into the dormitory at Stanford University, an hour away, where he was going to be an entering freshman. Lesh should have known the enterprise of the Deadheads better. In a short time, they had discovered that Stanford ordered parents to leave by 6 p.m. Saturday, so their children could start their college careers unimpeded by parental supervision. On his fall Phil and Friends tour of the East Coast and South, Lesh brought Chris Robinson of the Black Crows. With Jimmy Herring unavailable, he called Larry Campbell, Dylan's old guitarist he ran into at the Jammies. Campbell fit with the band like a puzzle piece. He was in the guitar chair for Lesh's big New Year's Eve concert at the 7,000-seat Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco, with Ryan Adams back on vocals, Red Rocks all forgiven. Lesh was still the outlier critic, sticking up for the Deadheads in November, when Grateful Dead Productions clamped down on the tape traders. It may not have been the smartest move the Dead ever made, but Lesh wasted no time in abandoning any kind of united front. With sales of CDs down dramatically, not just Dick's Picks, but the entire industry, the internet loomed as the new avenue of distribution for recordings. After the introduction of iTunes by Apple in 2001, the music business started to see downloads as the next format, although there were issues around digital rights management that needed to be solved. The Dead began posting concert recordings on the band's website and offering downloads for a pricey $18, although the files could be copied. Sometime around Thanksgiving, it occurred to GDP CEO Sears that the band was competing with massive numbers of Dead concerts already posted on the web and available for free. He contacted the Internet Music Archive, www.archive.net, home to thousands of Dead concert recordings, and asked the site to bar any future downloads. He might as well have set off a bomb in Deadland. The outrage from Deadheads was instantaneous. Thousands of fans signed an online petition overnight. It wasn't only that the Dead had pulled down the soundboard recordings that were the official property of the band, but they also banned the tapes fans made and traded under the full approval and even auspices of the band. At the heart of the band's complex relationship with their following were the tape traders. For years, the tapers operated with impunity at the shows, from a special section set aside exactly for that purpose, a tiny forest of microphones clustered over the crowd. The dead have always had a loose relationship with their intellectual rights. Garcia's proclamation that whatever the fans wanted to do with the music was okay, after we're through with it, was more than authorization. It was the crucial piece in the band's compact with the Deadheads. The tapes fostered new generations of fans and served to create a worldwide community that shared the music and saw these tapes as a product of hippie ideals. Lesh jumped to the Deadheads' defense. He immediately posted a statement condemning the action on his website. "I was not part of this decision-making process, and I was not notified that the shows were going to be pulled. I do feel that the music is the Grateful Dead's legacy, and I hope that one way or another, all of it is available for those who want it," he wrote. The next day, the band capitulated. They agreed to allow audience-recorded tapes to be freely traded on the site, but reserved the soundboard tapes as streaming only. It was not so surprising a teapot tempest in the volatile world of the often entitled Deadheads, but the attention paid this minor matter was indicative of how mainstream the Dead's following had become in the years since Garcia's death. The august New York Times not only devoted two daily news stories to the controversy, but a third think piece by lead pop critic John Pareles explained why it all mattered. On their own, the band had been meeting with an accountant and financial advisor named Tim Jorstad, who worked with the other Marin County rock musicians like the members of Santana, the Doobie Brothers, and Journey. Jorstad had long worked with some of the band and had served as Kreutzmann's proxy at many GDP board meetings. Jorstad counseled the band to cut overhead severely. While Sears was on the East Coast at his family's old summer home dealing with his father's diagnosis of lymphoma, the band met over Italian food in Mill Valley and decided to follow Jorstad's advice. Weir and his wife called Sears in tears to tell him about the meeting. "We're shutting it down," they told him. While Sears did not understand the urgency, he agreed to Jill Lesh's demand that he take a call with Jorstad to discuss the situation before he returned home 2 days later. Sears dutifully made the call from a bench at the Boston Science Museum with his kids in tow and reached Jorstad on his phone, driving his Porsche to a dental appointment, seemingly unaware of any urgency, breezy and unconcerned. Sears returned home depressed and discouraged. He had thought he was streamlining the business, not folding it. He felt betrayed. The band's new record deal neared completion. Rhino Entertainment was changing their business model and targeted the Grateful Dead as a pilot project, putting Sears, John Scher, and Hal Kant in the enviable position of negotiating a beneficial deal. As the revenues from CD sales plummeted, labels were seeking different approaches to dealing with bands. Rhino wanted to assume control of the Dead's entire business, especially the Vault, and demonstrate to other successful classic rock bands how well this kind of an operation could be run. As record sales evaporated, these so-called 360 deals were a new wrinkle in the music business. Rhino was owned by Time Warner Incorporated, so the label had full access to the Dead's Warner Brothers catalog and had already released two doorstop boxed sets of the band's Warner Brothers releases. Despite Lesh's previous statement about never leasing the Vault, Rhino negotiated a 10-year license to the entire business of the Grateful Dead. All their recordings, merchandise, logos, emblems, intellectual properties, their website, the works. For a sum said to approach an astronomical $30 million, $3 million a year. One morning in May 2006, temperature-controlled moving trucks pulled up in the parking lot at Belle Marin Keys, and the Vault was loaded up and shipped off to some Fort Knox-like tape facility Warner Brothers operated in Burbank. The split was leaking into public view. "I think it was a common thought that if we got rid of the business, we might become friends again," Hart told the Marin Independent Journal. We might actually play again. We really love each other, and deep down, we're tied at the heart. Our friendship needs to be renewed, but we could never do it around a boardroom table. Now, we have nothing to fight over. This is a great load off of me, and all of us in general, which is one of the reasons we thought it was a great deal. It had become unmanageable between the four of us. Board meetings were never our thing, even in the best of times. Rhino hired Grateful Dead merchandising manager Peter McQuaid as a consultant, thinking the company needed someone on their end with intimate knowledge of the Dead. This move did not make the Leshes happy, as they had fallen out with McQuaid and no longer wanted him involved in anything Grateful Dead. This time, however, they could not pressure someone to fire him. In one of those juxtapositions of events that said far more than could be written off to simple coincidence, the same week they came for the vault, Ramrod died. He had been on the bus with Ken Kesey, and, in strange but important ways, was as much the heart and soul of the Grateful Dead as anyone. The band recognized his stature among them. Back in the giddy early days, before they became big business, the band found it necessary to first incorporate their business affairs. When they had to name officers for chairman of the board, they selected Ramrod. Lawrence Shurtleff, his given name, came to the band during the first year and stayed for the entire ride. A lifelong smoker, he developed lung cancer and didn't hang around long. Typically, he kept it quiet, but band members and crew visited him in the hospital daily. His loss was traumatic to the Dead family. He was our rock, said Weir. If that wasn't enough, 2 weeks later, the harried, depressive Vince Welnick, long estranged from his former Dead colleagues, slashed his own throat, in full view of his horrified wife, who was forced to watch him die. The Dead family turned up for support. Parrish was on the scene as soon as he got the call. Weir brought his wife and family over to Welnick's house later that day. His friends knew how depressed he had been. Many heard him speak of suicide. He was also in the middle of switching antidepressant medicines, which can be a dangerous time. Still, his death came as a harsh shock, a sad end to a turbulent life. Now that Rhino was minding the store, Hart certainly wasn't sitting around waiting for something to happen. With Kreutzmann living in Marin and the two of them getting along especially well, he returned with a new edition of his all-percussion band, Planet Drum, with deadmate and rhythm partner Kreutzmann beside him. Along with bassist Mike Gordon of Fish and guitarist Steve Kamak, Hart brought North Indian tabla master Zakir Hussain, Nigerian hand drummer Sekiru Adipoju, and Puerto Rican percussionist Giovanni Hidalgo. With Kreutzmann on board, they called the band the Rhythm Devils, a term that dated back to their drum solos during the 70s, made official by director Francis Ford Coppola when he hired them to produce a combustive percussion piece for the soundtrack to his 1980 film Apocalypse Now. After test driving the unit at the Jammies in April, right before he went on tour with Particle, Hart booked a full-scale nationwide tour in July, and talked again with the Marin Independent Journal before the band's appearance as the opening act of the annual San Francisco Jazz Festival in September. He didn't sound especially hopeful when asked about the Dead playing together again. The healing has begun, he said. Once we got rid of the business, we don't have anything to argue about anymore, really. Hopefully, we'll renew our friendships. We're starting to get together again socially. Because in order to make Grateful Dead music, you've got to really love each other. To do it really successfully and right, it's not about the music. It's about the interpersonal relationships between the players. It's about trust and love and all those crazy things. And that's coming back. So I look forward to someday when we can all be on the same stage and laugh and smile and feel good about each other and play our music. It's not over till it's over, and it ain't over yet. In the meantime, there's Planet Drum and the Rhythm Devils. Hart exaggerated. The band members weren't speaking. He and Weir talked, but Lesh had nothing to do with them. They all had their own bands. The vault was gone. Ramrod was dead. The real estate was sold. The office was closed. The sun had set on the Grateful Dead. Chapter 14. Obama. In August 2007, Phil Lesh arranged to take his son Brian to New York City for a taping of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. It was Brian's 18th birthday. The featured guest was Senator Barack Obama, a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. Brian, a senior at the exclusive Branson School in Ross, was an avid Obama volunteer who attended meetings run by the National High School campaign director in her Palo Alto bedroom. He went to a three-day Camp Obama that summer to train organizers and campaign workers. His rock star father pulled a few strings and scored the tickets to the TV taping. At the show, Obama shook hands briefly with Lesh and his family as he left. But later that evening, the Leshes attended an Obama rally before an overflow audience at the New York Marriott Hotel at the Brooklyn Bridge. The 46-year-old junior senator from Illinois, lean, poised, and relaxed, electrified the crowd. He warmed up with folksy recollections of his student days living in an apartment in the recently gentrified Park Slope neighborhood. I couldn't afford it now. Before turning to rallying cries for health care, against the Iraq War, it's not going well, seeking Osama bin Laden, and emptying Guantanamo, I want to restore habeas corpus. He was firm, fair, measured, but the speech was shot through with his unique, understated charisma. He led the crowd to a rousing finale, getting them to scream and holler with him like a Baptist preacher. Fired up, ready to go. Fired up, ready to go. Fired up, ready to go. Thank you, Brooklyn. Let's go change the world. Lesh was swept up by the performance, the hairs on his neck standing on end. Since Brian was an official in the Obama Youth Organization, he was invited backstage to meet Obama, who then came back out with Brian to meet his parents. They engaged in small talk, and Obama asked about Lesh's profession. I played bass in the Grateful Dead for 30 years, Lesh said. Obama brightened. I enjoy your music very much, he said. Lesh asked if he had ever attended any Dead concerts, and Obama told Lesh he had not seen the band, but he had their music on his iPod. The Leshes glowed at this moment. Jill Lesh, as taken by the experience as her son and husband, spoke up. We can get the hippie vote for you, she said. Obama smiled, and her husband echoed his wife and offered to help any way he could. Within days, Obama's staff reached out to speak with Lesh. He started to make plans to hold a Phil and Friends benefit for the Obama campaign, but Brian wouldn't hear of it. No, he told his father, you've got to get the Dead together because it will be much more meaningful and important. Nobody had been thinking about playing music together again. Everybody was actively pursuing projects on their own, freed from the Grateful Dead, and not even really in touch with one another. Another reunion wasn't something anybody had even considered. The other three might have thought about it if they were speaking with Lesh. Things did not end well between them. Lesh had recently run into Weir, shopping at the Apple Store in Marin, so they were talking again, to a degree, but Hart was a different matter. Lesh, who spent a weekend in January canvassing Obama voters and going unrecognized in Nevada, bravely put in a call. I was about to call you for the same reason, said Hart, whose intense political enthusiasms had already led him to Obama. On Monday, February 4th, 2008, the eve of the California primary, a key state in the Super Tuesday delegate sweepstakes, where Obama trailed rival Hillary Clinton in the polls by as much as 10 points, Deadheads for Obama drew a raving full house to the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, where Bobby Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh were going to perform together on behalf of the Obama campaign. Kreutzmann, who had moved back to Hawaii the previous year, was not available. Obama wanted to bring America together, and he was going to start with the Grateful Dead. Outside on the sidewalk, people were offering as much as $300 for a ticket. Inside, the tie-dyed deadheads were waving Obama signs. Because this was the big event of the night for the campaign in town, every political reporter and television crew assigned to the Obama beat in Northern California crowded into the tiny basement area outside the dressing rooms for a press conference before the show. Lesh extolled the virtues of their candidate and talked about how the dead men were bonded as brothers. He told about calling and soliciting Hart as if they spoke every day. As the political reporters, unfamiliar with the personalities involved, dutifully scribbled down Lesh's proclamations of unity, one of the town's music writers stepped out from behind a camera and asked Hart how long it had actually been since the three of them had even seen each other. "I see Bobby every week," Hart said. "Phil, it's been years and years." The evening opened with a video message from the candidate himself on a screen in the middle of the stage, as the band members milled around and watched. "Hi, everybody. This is Barack Obama," he said. "And I just want to thank Phil and Bob and Mickey for helping pull this together. You know, Phil's son Brian cut his summer short to join this campaign for change. It's young people like that, all across the country, who are rediscovering a sense of idealism and possibility. For all of you to come together and help put on this concert to encourage people to vote is extraordinary. So I want to say thank you to all of you. I want everybody to sit down and enjoy the music." Deadhead smothered the instructions to sit down with cheers. "And make sure you vote tomorrow, because if we vote, we not only got a chance to win the election, but we got a chance to change the country and change the world." With undead-like surgical timing, as applause died for Obama's video, the band rolled into Playing in the Band, and the place exploded. It was a makeshift Dead, the current edition of Phil and Friends, plus Weir, Hart, and Ratdog guitarist Karen. But the band was on fire, everybody clearly pumped by the three-quarters reunion and the excitement of the occasion. Lesh's latest band not only included drummer Molo and guitarist Larry Campbell, but singer-songwriter Jackie Green, keyboardist Steve Moletz of Particle, and steel guitarist Barry Sless. The band brought the brief opening set to a close with the Beatles' Come Together, a most appropriate selection that Rat Dog had been performing, but Lesh's band took pains to learn that evening during soundcheck. At the end of the 40-minute set, Lesh read a campaign speech, clearly crafted by the campaign for him, full of "Yes, we can," and "Fired up, ready to go." Hart echoed the endorsement, and Weir took a poll from the crowd to find out when were they going to vote the next day, in the morning, lunchtime, or after work. The seven-piece band returned for two more dazzling sets. Green mowed down Sugaree, a song he had been performing not only with Phil and Friends, but in his own shows as well. At the close of the thrilling evening, Lesh appended his customary donor rap with an appeal for fans to volunteer the next day to help get out the vote. The final song was, what else? U.S. Blues. While the band played, some crazed hippie dashed back and forth at the back of the stage, waving a giant American flag. By the time he reached the front of the stage and the band charged into the song's final choruses, the hippie had changed his flag to one with the peace sign where the stars usually are. The Deadheads burst into cheers. The next day, Obama punched his way to an 8-point loss to Clinton. The Deadhead vote Jill Lesh promised to deliver did not swing the day, but the Dead's drawing power on the East Coast was not lost on the Obama campaign, who, in the fall election, smelling victory in the perennial swing state of Pennsylvania and looking to load up resources in the state, asked Lesh if the band might be able to hold a fundraiser. By this time, plans were already quietly underway to mount a full-scale Dead reunion the following year, Although the official word from the dead camp was that this would be a one-time-only event, and any future reunions would wait until after Pennsylvania. Behind the scenes, Live Nation had made an attractive offer for a modest sum of dates with a guarantee of $1 million per show. Only the details remained to be ironed out. On October 13th, at the Bryce Jordan Center at Pennsylvania State University, with Billy Kreutzmann on board, the fully reformed Dead played a concert called Change Rocks, with the Allman Brothers opening, that raised $500,000 for the campaign. Guitarist Warren Haynes played in both bands and stayed on the stage all night. "It's a beautiful night," he told the crowd during the Allman's opening set. "It's an historic night. Don't forget to vote." This would be the sixth new edition of the Grateful Dead since Garcia died. It had been almost 4 years since the four had last performed together. They had all followed different individual paths in the intervening years, but nobody had found the same kind of connection with the crowd or other musicians as they did when they played together. "We're all deeply into this," Hart said to Rolling Stone backstage. "Into Barack Obama and the thought of taking this country back in some shape or form, what's left of it. It's probably one thing we can all agree on. It's funny that an Obama event would do that, but that's how important and critical this election is. It's our call to arms, or call to music, which is the way we arm ourselves." After another Obama video speech during the break, "For 20 months, I've been traveling this country from town to town, even developing a touch of gray of my own," Obama said. "On November 5th, I hope to announce that we ain't wasting time no more." The band swung into immediate action with Truckin', stretched into a delirious 10-minute romp, which led to a rollicking U.S. blues, an almost ridiculously upbeat opening segment that soon veered into less productive areas. The band lost its footing and never regained the altitude. There had been no real rehearsals. Lesh squeezed in the show between Phil and Friends dates on an East Coast tour. Rat Dog had been out all summer, with more dates starting later in October. Both Hart and Kreutzmann had been touring with their own bands that summer. Coming together between all their own tours and projects, the Pennsylvania show by the revived Dead might have suffered as a consequence. Weir followed Lesh's donor rap with remarks of his own. He quoted Gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson. "If every Deadhead who lived in Florida had voted in 2000, it would be a very different world today." The band then launched into Touch of Grey, followed by a thunderous Not Fade Away, to bring the two-hour concert to a close. In the end, the band weathered the rough spots to rediscover their primal connection. Lesh raved about Weir's vocal prowess, and Kreutzmann boasted he and Hart were clicking again. "Mickey and I are getting along better now," he told Rolling Stone. "The egos are out of the way." Since closing the office and parting ways in 2006, both Lesh and Weir had been keeping busy schedules with their individual bands. Over the past several years, Rat Dog had grown in popularity, and Phil and Friends, at the least, had leveled off. Since Robin Sylvester replaced Rob Wasserman in the band, and Rat Dog took a sharp turn into serious jamming and hard rocking, the crowds had been building. At the same time, the revolving cast of Phil and Friends, plus the band's decreasing novelty, was losing ground with the Deadheads. Guitarist Larry Campbell, who replaced Herring as his main guitarist, was not as beloved by the audience, and the addition of guests like the arcane jazz guitarist John Scofield, however entertaining he may have been for Lesh, left the fans somewhat less enthusiastic. Rat Dog had developed a serious following after years of dogged touring and evolving the band. In April 2008, for the third year in a row, Rat Dog sold out three nights at the Beacon Theater in New York. Although Weir worked out daily and had a health regime that extended to esoteric ginseng extracts that cost hundreds of dollars a bottle he took before shows, he was a mess. He was drinking heavily, often to a near-comatose state, made all the more dangerous by his fondness for pharmaceuticals. He often complained of shoulder pain from throwing a football. He played with the same bunch of local guys at public parks around Mill Valley every weekend he was in town, or hanging a guitar from his shoulder, and he took painkillers, booze and downers. In July, after he played a local benefit, a friend found him collapsed, trembling, and unable to speak on the front bench outside the 2 a.m. club, a well-known Mill Valley watering hole. The bar owner called an ambulance. Weir toured almost compulsively. He went out for 3 6-week tours a year, and in between played festivals and weekend gigs. During his infrequent stays at home, he could be found sitting in with other bands around town or playing benefit concerts for environmental or political causes. Rat Dog played the band's 850th show, New Year's Eve 2008, at the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco, headlined by Phil and Friends, with the band's roster undisturbed since bassist Sylvester joined 5 years before. Lesh also had learned the benefits of having, at least, a longer-term band. Guitarist Larry Campbell continued to serve as his musical consigliere, and Particles' Steve Molitz was holding down the keyboard chair with Molo at the drum kit. In July 2007, Lesh added 26-year-old Jackie Green to his Phil and Friends repertory company. Green was a promising Dylan-esque singer-songwriter, and a musical throwback to his parents' generation, who released his major label debut, American Myth, on Verve Forecast in 2006. Raised in the gold rush town of Placerville in the Sierra Nevada foothills, young Green absorbed his parents' record collection at an early age and recorded his own debut CD in a home studio while still in high school. His 2002 Gone Wanderin' album on a Sacramento-based independent label won widespread acclaim and some airplay across Northern California. His major label outing featured Elvis Costello's rhythm section and was produced by Steve Berlin of Los Lobos, but failed to launch. Lesh first heard Green's title song from Gone Wanderin' on KFOG, the San Francisco rock radio station, and checked out his set at Bonnaroo in 2007. A month or so later, Lesh phoned Green and asked if he would be interested in helping him make some music. Green, who knew nothing of the Grateful Dead's music, leaped at the opportunity. His major label release was a stiff. Green, who had moved to San Francisco, was sleeping in the equipment locker of the Mission Street District recording studio he shared with Tim Bloom of Mother Hips and Dave Brogan of Animal Liberation Orchestra. His 94 Jetta was falling apart. When he landed the job with Phil and Friends, he was finally able to afford his own small apartment. The next month, he was dropped on stage before a capacity crowd at Red Rocks singing his Tell Me Mama, Tell Me Right, along with the Dead material with Phil and Friends. Green brought youthful good looks and enthusiasm, a handful of his songs, a few more Dylan tunes, and his own classic rock sensibilities. With Larry Campbell adding judicious touches of mandolin and even fiddle to the band, Green's backwoods holler and acoustic guitar made this version of Phil and Friends an entirely more flexible band than the storied Q, even if the latest edition lacked the Q's firepower. This new reunion of the Dead came at a curious juncture in the schedules of the four principals. Even Kreutzmann was working. After the Dead splintered in 2006, he had joined up with Hart to revive the Rhythm Devils with Steve Kamuk, Fish bassist Mike Gordon, African talking drummer Sikuru Adipoju, and a few new Robert Hunter songs. He had moved back to Hawaii in 2007 after divorcing his fourth wife. It was bassist Gordon who introduced Kreutzmann to guitarist Scott Murawski of Max Creek when the three performed together at a benefit concert in Costa Rica. When Kreutzmann suggested a more permanent arrangement, Gordon bowed out, but Allman Brothers bassist Oteil Burbidge accepted. Originally called the Bill Kreutzmann Trio, but soon shortened to BK3, the band mixed Dead covers with old Max Creek songs, new originals by Murawski, and a couple of new Hunter songs, and played a Northeast tour in summer 2008 and a round of West Coast dates in early 2009. Kreutzmann was also cooking up music with another associate. He first heard Louisiana native Papa Molly at the Oregon County Fair in summer 2008 and joined the eccentric guitarist and vocalist for a New Year's Eve gig with Bonnie Raitt bassist Hutch Hutchinson, who also lives in Hawaii at the Pauwela Cannery in upcountry Maui. Hart was also busy, as usual. He had the Mickey Hart Band on tour all summer 2008, whose returning members included Kamak and Adipoju, alongside New Orleans R&B bassist George Porter of the Meters, drummer Walfredo Reyes Jr., and keyboardist Kyle Hollingsworth from String Cheese Incident. Hart also picked up his second Grammy Award for his latest world beat percussion album, Global Drum Project. With Rat Dog and Phil and Friends also in action, all four had full dance cards when they paused in spring 2009 to play the short but lucrative tour for Live Nation as The Dead. The originally planned 14 dates were expanded to 23 cities over 5 weeks in April and May 2009. After the Penn State debacle during the Obama campaign, they managed to squeeze in 11 days rehearsal at Weir's rented studio in San Rafael in February. The mission was to return with as much money as possible. The coffers were empty. After 4 years of working their solo acts, the four men's revenue stream had thinned out considerably. Their big money deal with Rhino turned out to return about half what the band had been making on Grateful Dead records. The Leshes suggested that the members' personal managers sit out the tour. It was agreed. Other options were explored. At first, the band considered hiring mega manager Irving Azoff, who handled the Eagles and other top rock acts, after Hart was introduced to Azoff by Sammy Hagar. Azoff had managed Van Halen when Hagar rejoined for the 2005 reunion tour, but that unlikely association never happened. Corin Capshaw, manager of the Dave Matthews Band, was dying to handle the tour, but the band members ultimately agreed to work without management to avoid paying commissions, instead hiring Tim Jorstad to work as a consultant paid a $500 hourly fee. Carol Hart took time out from studying for her PhD at UC Berkeley to act as her husband's surrogate, understanding that she wouldn't be paid. Taking that role also meant she had to interact regularly with Jill Lesh, who was Phil's manager. Carol didn't see that as a problem, as she considered Jill a friend, who had even thrown her a baby shower when she was pregnant with her daughter Rhea. But the Jill she encountered now was a different woman, harsh, antagonistic, and controlling. She quickly tired of being on the receiving end of screaming phone calls from Jill, who could take issue with the smallest things. This was not the way the Dead handled things. It was the Leshes who had declared themselves keepers of the soul of the Grateful Dead. More importantly, the Leshes were indisputably in charge of the Dead. Carol came to dread interactions with the Leshes. She began to pop Valiums before taking business meetings to help cope with Jill's nonstop talking. Relations were also strained, to say the least, by the Leshes' constant complaints and demands for more money. Their past threats the previous couple of years to sue the other partners over business issues didn't help. If Lesh envisioned himself as a leader who would take over after Garcia and direct the band's fortunes, nobody was following him. Not voluntarily, at least. On the eve of the reunion announcement, planned for New Year's Eve, 2008, Jorstad received a 3 a.m. email from Kreutzmann in Hawaii. "I want nothing more to do with the Grateful Dead," he wrote. "Leave me out of it." Jorstad, who never knew who was authoring recent emails from Hawaii, Kreutzmann or his new girlfriend, Amy Moorhead, called the Leshes to ask if the email sounded like Kreutzmann. They assured him it did indeed sound like Kreutzmann, so Jorstad now had to quickly contemplate the announcement he and Live Nation were planning to make the next day. There would be a giant difference between a reunion of the surviving original members, the so-called Core Four, and Three Out of Four. In a panic, Jorstad dispatched Kreutzmann's grown filmmaker son, Justin Kreutzmann to Hawaii to get his father to call Jorstad. When he finally spoke to him, Kreutzmann claimed the email was nothing more than a joke. Kreutzmann may have relented, but he maintained a dark, sulky mood for the duration of the tour. He showed up in poor physical condition and struggled to keep up with the much more physically fit Hart for the whole tour. The band hoped to unveil the new edition at a free concert in New York City on March 30th, but weather and city permits scotched that plan in favor of three shows in one night at small Manhattan venues. The 4,000 tickets were distributed to fans through an online lottery. The morning began with Weir, Lesh, and touring guitarist Warren Haynes playing Friend of the Devil on morning TV talk show The View. Host Whoopi Goldberg was a longtime Dead fan. At 5 in the afternoon, the same three gave a rare acoustic performance at a former Lower East Side synagogue called Angel Oren Sands that focused on Working Man's Dead and American Beauty material, although the highlight of the hour-long set was a near 20-minute, largely instrumental version of Birdsong. At 8 o'clock that night, drummers Hart and Kreutzmann, with keyboardist Jeff Cementi, joined the three guitarists at Gramercy Theater on East 23rd Street for a full electric band romp that began with a half-hour jam and playing in the band. The evening ended with a two-hour session uptown at the Roseland Ballroom, where 3,000 fans were treated to a rocking set of fan favorites, such as Eyes of the World, Cassidy, St. Stephen, a twisting, turning dark star, and a celebratory Sugar Magnolia finale, Haynes topping the mix with Chuck Berry riffs. "It's just like playing a three-hour show," Weir told Rolling Stone, "but it's broken up by cab rides." The tour began 2 weeks later in Greensboro, North Carolina, and almost immediately, tempo wars broke out on stage. Weir and Kreutzmann would engage in duels, Weir fighting to slow the rhythm, Kreutzmann trying to drive the beat back up. The next day was a day off before appearing at the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C., and the band accepted an invitation to meet with President Obama in the Oval Office of the White House. Band members and wives talked history with the down-to-earth president. Jill Lesh spotted a vase of scarlet begonias on the way out of the Oval Office, to everyone's delight. After all, it was Obama's campaign that had fostered this current reunion, and the place was lousy with deadheads. They were ushered into Chief of Staff David Axelrod's office to meet with the senior deadheads on the staff, all of whom intended to attend the concert the following night, where Tipper Gore sat in on drums. After the first week, Jorstad went home, but a week later he received an aggrieved phone call from Lesh, who demanded that he return immediately to the tour and straighten out the situation. Lesh was unhappy with the musical performances and wanted Jorstad to settle the problems. Jorstad flew from California straight to backstage at Madison Square Garden in New York. He feared the tour would be canceled and the money would have to be returned to Live Nation. With tickets costing as much as $100, sales had not been as brisk as Live Nation had hoped. Although the last tour in 2004 had earned $18 million, the current tour could wind up losing money for the company, and they were getting nervous. Jorstad did not want to give them an excuse to cancel. The next night, he brought all four together in a backstage room before the show and explained the financial realities and possible consequences of their disputes. Jorstad counseled the band to resolve their differences. He knew Weir thought Lesh played so loud, he had to scream to sing. He knew Lesh thought Kreutzmann was rushing the beat. Jorstad advised the band to keep in mind they had not been playing together for more than 5 years. "I don't know what your expectations were," he told them, "but perfection is not on the menu." Jorstad reiterated the complaints band members had expressed to him, but not to each other, about one another. "These feelings needed to be aired," he said, but he also reminded the band that their fans, in the middle of a severe economic recession, had paid big money to attend these shows, and the band owed these people a good show. Jorstad resolved to stay with the band for the duration of the tour, even though it would increase his fee. Thinking it would be shrewd to keep her busy, Jorstad gave various minor duties to Jill Lesh. She was smart and capable enough and took care of some of the details for him, although he knew it could cause huge trouble if other band members found out. She had been working the Phil and Friends tours for 10 years, which made her far more experienced than Jorstad. She also had a close working relationship with Matt Bush, the young Rat Dog.